Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation. It is Monday, October 7th. It has been a year of escalation of violence in a Middle East conflict where tens of thousands of people have died. There are renewed calls for peace amidst a vigil and a march and a growing sense of loss on all sides of this war. There are calls for more transparency in the process to select the new president of the University of Hawaii. Should the deliberation process and interviews by the Board of Regents be held behind closed doors? From a parking lot to a paved paradise, how business is booming at the Aloha Stadium complex, even with the actual stadium closed to the public. And we mourn the loss of a member of the HPR family, former general manager Michael Titterton. We reflect back on his contributions to our community. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Today marks 1 year since Hamas attacked towns along Israel's border, taking hundreds of people hostage and killing close to 2,000 people. The violence that followed in Gaza would kill 43,000, many children. One of those young children was a 14-year-old cousin of Honolulu resident Ma'an Oda. We spoke with him at the start of a peace march from Ala Moana to Waikiki that took place this past Saturday. Oda called the situation in the Middle East dire. It's not hard to feel his grief and to understand what drives his strong political views on this war.
This is absolutely shameful. And so we are gathered here today to send a strong message that we stand for justice no matter what, and that we are absolutely against the atrocities that have been committed in our tax dollars.
And so tell me about your family that's still over there.
My family, one-fourth of my immediate family, is sheltering in Rafah right now. They've been displaced 8 consecutive times. I've lost 2 cousins and one of my best friends in Gaza. And that is absolute tragedy. But what's far more important is that what these people have been subject to, from psychological trauma, from physical trauma, will last generations to come, and it's an absolute shame that the world is allowing such things to happen.
And so when were you last in contact with your family?
I'm in contact with them about once every other week on average. Sometimes I'm lucky and I hear from them twice a week, but that really depends on the internet. It really depends on their availability, whether they're changing and being displaced. Currently, they're at the United Nations school shelter in Rafah, which was recently bombed. And I did hear back from them since, but a lot of their neighbors have been murdered. And, you know, we don't want to get into the details, but I think what's very important to understand is that the genocide is absolutely does not discriminate between a Christian, a Muslim, a Jew, whoever is in Gaza right now is subject to murder.
And so I don't know what your story is, you know, how you came here to Hawaii. Were you here studying at the university?
No, it's a long story that's somewhat irrelevant to this conversation, but I will mention that I was born and raised in Palestine in Bethlehem. Until I was 18 years old, and then I was traveling for school on the East Coast. I attended Brown University, and then I came here for the graduate school for a bit, but then I ended up doing my medical degree at NYU, so I am an MNT right now, practicing. I have my private practice. But as a Palestinian, it shames me that the government of the United States is literally funding the genocide against my people. And one last thing about the people, my cousins and my best friend that I lost, those people who are brilliant human beings. You know, my best friend is good looking, he's smart, he's educated, he's got stories, he's got a morning routine, he's got a pre-bed routine. So he's not just some random number that you see on a screen. And it aches me to see another number add up on a CNN news channel or across the TV screen. It's an absolute shame that we think of these people as numbers, but these people are smarter than us, and they are, have a life just like us.
And so have they been able to have funeral services for your friend or your cousins?
It's a good question, and absolutely not. It is my first cousin that I lost. Her name is Hannah, and she's 14 years old. She's a tennis player, and she was murdered on the second week of genocide.
So last year, last October?
Last October, yeah. So it was October 22 that was essentially she was murdered. And not until April 13 was her family able to collect her remnants. And it was in skeletons. It was not in one tissue form that you would imagine. So even embracing our beloved dead is a privilege these days. So having a funeral, having somebody remember you or even have any recollection of your body is an absolute privilege these days. Because people are dying in the hundreds and thousands, so you can't really have enough time for that.
I mean, I remember when we were last here for the rally at Ulamoana Beach Park, and then I think the numbers were 20,000, you know, now it's more than 40. And so, you know, the march here, you folks are calling for peace. You just want it to stop.
We genuinely and simply want a ceasefire right now. And the fact that this is controversial is mind-boggling and should be an obvious to any human being that a ceasefire should happen and that children should not be murdered, no matter what. This is what we're demanding, and we will never stop. But even beyond the ceasefire, what Palestinians have been subject to before that is absolutely intolerable. And it's despicable that the government continues to fund this such genocide and atrocities.
And folks are just worried that this will lead to just, you know, regional war and something even more protracted. I mean, who knew that it would even last a year? We were all hoping that there would be a ceasefire sooner and this would just end.
Well, it turns out if you go invade a country and piss off the neighbors, that everybody will be mad at you. And so what Israel has done in 1948 was displace, especially, you know, personally, me and my family, I lived in a refugee camp my entire life. Scarce water, scarce electricity, scarce power. My education, I would have to sneak out of the house in order to get to my education classes. My entire life has been under occupation and militarization. It is absolutely inhuman not to expect humans to react to such atrocities. If you subject a cat, if you put a cat in a cage, it will scratch you the second it gets a chance to do so. If you deprive if it's food, if it's water, if it's vital necessities, it will scratch you the second it gets a chance. And so how do we not expect humans to do the same? So what I'm saying is that the only solution forward is for occupation to stop and for the colonization of the land to stop. That's all we're asking. We're not asking for anybody to move away. We're not asking for people to be displaced again. We're not asking for the vicious cycle of violence to continue. We're simply asking for occupation to stop. And if that's controversial, then you're on the wrong side of history.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate you sharing your story.
Yeah, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
That was Ma Oda, who is from Palestine, and who we talked to this past Saturday. This morning, we talked to the rabbi of the Chabad of Hawaii here on Oahu. The congregation is holding a vigil that is to start at 7 p.m. tonight. It will also hold a screening of a documentary film entitled October 7th, The Voices of Pain, Hope, and Heroism. The gathering will also feature a talk by one woman who survived the attack on the Nova Music Festival a year ago. Here is Rabbi Itchel Kasinjaski.
1,200 innocent, beautiful people who gathered for a celebration were murdered in cold blood. And in the most cruel, horrific way, over 200 people, young people for the most part, were taken hostage and are still being kept in the dark tunnels in Gaza, and many of them have been killed since, but there are some that are still alive. So our heart bleeds for them and aches for them. So we're coming together to give expression to all of this, especially in this time of crisis. You know, we seek to come together and give strength to one another. You mentioned of so many people died. I don't know if you're referring to Palestinians who've died in this clash, and that's, we don't celebrate that. It's actually a tragedy that innocent people die. But the onus and the responsibility is clearly on Hamas and Hezbollah, who embed themselves in civilian neighborhoods, with turn every house and every mosque into a military, command post, to use it to kill innocent Israelis. So Israel has no choice. It goes to great lengths to try to avoid loss of innocent lives. That's why, like no other military in the world, in war, does it give a forewarning to people to leave the area, which is an area that they need to go in and to fight the terrorists. They do that, and still there are casualties.
At your vigil tonight, you will have a guest speaker who was at the music festival on October 7th last year. Talk to us about her story.
Well, I don't know her story yet, to be honest with you. She was here. She was visiting here a couple of months ago, and she did share her story at an event here. I wasn't there, but I was told it was very moving. We did speak to some survivors from the Nova Festival, and every survivor there will tell you that the fact that they have survived is a clear miracle. You know, one in, I don't know how many tens or more, survived. Most were killed, were shot at and killed. I do know that one of the stories of one of the survivors is the story of actually someone who wasn't even there at Nova, but his son was there. And he's a retired general in the Israeli army. And when he heard of what happened, and was able to make contact with his son, who was living in, actually he wasn't at the Nova, but he was living in a kibbutz in the south, where the terrorists infiltrated and began shooting and killing. And he hid in his home, locked his home, and hid in his shelter room in his house. And he was talking to his father, a young man, two little children, a wife and two little children. And his father just jumped into the car. He was in Tel Aviv, in the center of Israel. And he drove down all the way, and he talks about how on the way he met survivors who were running away from, you know, from this massacre, and soldiers who were wounded on the way, and he stopped at every interval, and he saved the people that he could on the way until he finally got to the kibbutz where his son was living. By that time, he had come with some other soldiers who he picked up on the way, and they saved his son by clearing the area from terrorists. But yeah, there's unbelievable stories. This was just one of them. So we will talk about that.
That was Rabbi Itchel Kazanjatsky talking about a vigil that is to take place at 7 p.m. tonight here in Honolulu. The Chabad says it will have security in place across the country, temples are being urged to be on guard for any threats due to increased tensions in the Middle East on this anniversary. The rabbi says there will also be another vigil that he's aware of that's being held on Kauai tonight from 6 to 8 p.m. Mayor Derek Kawakami will speak at the Kauai War Memorial Convention Hall in Lihue. Look for links on the conversation page of our website after the show.
Support for HPR comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing access to affordable housing as part of their care for community members with intellectual and developmental disabilities, such as ARC of Maui County. NareitHawaii.com.
Monday marks 1 year since Israel was attacked by Hamas. Since then, the conflict in Gaza has cost tens of thousands of civilian lives. And now,
this is a tipping toward that much broader all-out regional war that many have feared and warned about.
1 year in the shadow of October 7th. Next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from TS Restaurants and its Legacy of Aloha Foundation, supporting the Maui community and assisting those affected by the wildfires. More about how to help by searching tsrestaurants.com Legacy of Aloha.
The Board of Regents of the University of Hawaii is expected to meet behind closed doors later this month to interview the two finalists vying to be UH's next president. HPR reporter Cassie Ordonio joins us this morning with a story about how some say the process needs to be more transparent. Good morning.
Good morning.
So what can you tell us about the final two?
So we have two finalists, which is Julian Vasquez Heilig and Wendy Hensel, both who are from the mainland, and those are the two finalists slated to be the next UH president. But the Board of Regents are slated to meet on October 16, where they'll do the interview process in executive session, which means behind closed doors, out of the public eye. And they could make a choice after the interview, or it could be the next day. But whoever the final pick is, they would have to get the job offering, negotiate the contract, and then the candidate that was picked needs to give their employer, their current employer, a heads up that they've accepted another position. And there are some public interest attorneys that raise concerns that those type of interviews, especially of a high public official like that, should be held in the public eye. And this is following a 2019 Hawaii Supreme Court ruling where boards and commissions are barred from holding closed meetings unless they prove they are protecting a legitimate privacy interest. I spoke with Brian Black, who is the executive director of the Public First Interest Center, who says the Sunshine Law does not allow for situations where you're hiring someone, especially of that stature, for it to be automatically in executive session, and particularly when you have a position like the UH president under consideration. He said that's something that should be done in the public.
Before 2019, many of the boards across the state took the position that the personnel privacy exception, which is an exception to the Sunshine Law that allows for closed meetings when there is a situation that an employee or officer is being hired, fired, disciplined, that type of a personnel action. And the way that the exception reads, there has to be the situation of hiring or firing, and it has to be a situation involving matters of privacy. And what the boards prior to 2019 did was they essentially said, if it involves hiring or firing or discipline, then it's a matter of privacy. So they collapsed down the standard, so it was just one thing. If it involved hiring, firing, or discipline, then they could go into executive session. That was their understanding. What the Hawaii Supreme Court explained in the case in 2019 was that, no, there's two different things that have to be satisfied there. One, there has to be a hiring or a firing or a discipline action being considered. So that's number one. If there is, then there also has to be matters affecting privacy involved. And the court explained some of the factors that go into whether or not there is a matter involving privacy. One of the factors that affects it is whether or not the person who is being considered for hiring or firing or discipline is someone who has a significant amount of fiscal or administrative responsibility, such as the UH president. So, and there's other factors as well. But the court was very clear that those are two different standards. So it's not just a question of whether or not it's hiring or firing. There also has to be evidence that matters affecting privacy are involved. So when you're talking about people just getting interviewed for a job, that's not matters affecting privacy. That goes to the heart of what should be public, which is the reason that they should be selected for the position.
And there's been three boards that already did their interview process of their chief executives in person. So, for example, the Maui Police Commission in 2021, the Board of Education in 2022, and more recently, the State Law Enforcement Standards Board this year. And speaking to Lance Collins, he said the BOR still needs to vote in order to go to executive session and needs to have two-thirds of their members to be present.
And so, gosh, I mean, you know, it's one thing, I guess, to have the interview process in the public and then, I guess, decide among themselves. So, you know, what does UH say? Are they going to change anything based on what these two attorneys have raised?
So the spokesperson, Dan Meisenzahl, said that they are compliant with the state sunshine law, citing an Office of Information Practices opinion, and that was after there was a lawsuit alleging the Agribusiness Development Corp hired its executive director in a series of unlawful closed meetings, but that litigation is still ongoing. But the UH spokesperson said that there has been more than 1,500 people attending a total of 8 public forums and 8 public houses for the two finalists, and he also continued that the videos of the forums are publicly posted on the UH President Search website. So there's been some processes and more community involvement. And Lance Collins did say that the process for community involvement, it has been more articulated by the BOR than in previous years, about 20 years ago when Evan Dobell was president.
So I guess then we'll see once the agenda gets posted, you know, what exactly is on there and how this plays out, or if there'll be an objection when they try and go behind closed doors?
Yeah, I believe for the Sunshine Law, I believe the agenda is supposed to be posted, I think, 6-7 days prior before the meeting. And so once the agenda is posted, we get to see what is on their agenda, and then possibly we'll see the executive session where they would have to vote.
Okay, all right. So we'll see if that gets posted on Thursday for the vote next week. All right, but thank you so much, Cassie.
Thanks for having me.
We've been hearing from HPR's Cassie Ordonio. Look for updates on this story at hawaiipublicradio.org. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. We're diving deep to the ocean bed in search of a species of coral fish that was named after the 44th President of the United States. Discovered almost a decade ago during a National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration research expedition, the small pink and yellow vertebrae is a type of basslet, a group of fish that includes many colorful reef species popular in the marine aquarium trade. The male fish has a distinctive spot on the dorsal fin near the tail. It's blue around the edge and red with yellow stripes in the center. It's also the only known species of coral reef fish endemic to Papahanao Makuakea Marine National Monument. According to NOAA scientist Randall Kosaki, quote, "The endemic species are unique contributions to global biodiversity. With the onslaught of climate change, we are at risk of losing some of these undiscovered species before we even know they exist," end quote. For today's quiz, can you tell us the scientific name of this fish found only in Papahanao Makuakea? Call 808-941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets an HPR reusable tote bag.
support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing access to affordable housing to those with intellectual and developmental disabilities, including ARC of Maui County. NareitHawaii.com.
Imagine being a stadium manager of a shutdown stadium. You might think the job would be a walk in the park, but Ryan Andrews has stayed busy as the Aloha Stadium's manager. Under his leadership, the stadium has seen a return to 90% of its pre-pandemic revenue. That's back when it had football games and was an operational stadium. Andrew sat down with the Conversation's Maddie Bender to talk about how his team made lemonade out of lemons by expanding the iconic swap meet and figuring out inventive uses of the Aloha Stadium's space, from parking lot concerts to an annual holiday light show.
I started in 2013-14 as in event operations, and then came back 2016 as the deputy manager. The stadium manager, Scott Jan, wonderful man, great mentor. His intention was to, you know, hand this thing off with a new stadium. Obviously, that didn't all the way happen, and COVID hit and things changed. And he finally said, you know what, I've done what I can do. I've gotten us through the hardest part of COVID. It's your ball, Ryan. Good luck. Tough role to step into. And I always joke, I am probably going to be the only stadium manager that actually never managed a fully operational stadium. We did have some events with like no fan UH games, but I mean, inside the stadium, no real major events, which is kind of sad.
It almost feels like then your training and also the mentorship that you had, none of it really came close to what your job actually looks like.
No, in fact, my job is so different now. In fact, I'm really full-fledged into the new iteration, which is the new Aloha Stadium Entertainment District, but also in the meantime, doing our best in what we're calling our transitional operation, still running. We have 100-acre land. People don't realize that. So we have, you know, the stadium that sits on about 20 acres and 80 acres and of open space that we use for a variety of things, everything from swap meet to concerts to Holiday Lights 50th State Fair, which I'm sure we'll get into, because that's been actually really interesting these last couple years. But my job really is to kind of get us through this transition and get us to the next phase.
Let's talk about the swap meet, because I think that is something that many people don't realize, the economics of it. So what goes on with that?
Yeah, so swap meet, first of all, is, I call it an event, but it's been around for 45 years. We're actually celebrating its 45th anniversary right now. It has always been a huge revenue stream for the stadium. In fact, usually about 50% of the stadium revenue came from the swap meet. But, you know, it never got a lot of attention because it was something that just happened every Wednesday, Saturday, Sunday. But we had other events that were going on. When COVID happened and we realized we weren't going to then reopen the stadium, that was the obvious place to start in terms of how to grow or rebrand or make it even more relevant was the swap meet. You know, you build on your strengths. So we took that full on and we, as a team, came together and said, how can we make this better? And obviously, food always comes up when people talk. And so we thought about, well, let's bring in food trucks and let's bring in a wide variety of food so it changes on a regular basis. So we started there. We talked about bringing in different entertainment activities. So we often do, you know, special craft fairs, or this last weekend, we actually had pickleball, which was pretty hilarious. We've done roller skating, all sorts of just ridiculously fun things just to get people to think about giving it another try, right? Because a lot of times from a local standpoint, you might go once a year before you go to the mainland to bring a bunch of little
tchotchkes,
yeah. That's the perfect way to put it, to your relatives. But you want to give people more reasons to come. So we've added some music sometimes, which is a great thing to get people back. So it's been fun. It's a huge revenue stream. So, and we actually grew that revenue in the last year and a half by over $1 million.
What do you think resulted in growing that revenue stream over the past year?
I think the food, I think the themes, I think also just outreaching to people that may not have considered the swap meet. So a lot of times you talk to small businesses that are even in Waikiki and they're paying a lot of money in lease rent. We get the same tourists at our place and they pay pennies on the dollar in terms of what it costs to be a vendor. So that word has gotten out and we actually have a lot of vendors that also have spaces in Waikiki. So we actually did at one point raise the rates a little bit on the vendors and we were concerned. And then we had these other vendors going, are you kidding me? This is the cheapest thing in town. We're happy to be here.
So there's a swap meet. There are then also all these other pop-up events, whether it be concerts or career days or even spay and neuter events.
So, correct. Just to back up a little bit, when we had an operable stadium, we had to make sure we had parking. So we couldn't use the parking lot for events that were longer than a day or what went through a weekend, because we had to keep those spaces for like a UH game. So when we knew those games weren't going to happen or those major events weren't going to happen inside the stadium, we could look at longer term activities in the parking lot. So obviously, we've had, historically, we've always had the 50th State Fair, and we've continued to do that. But we started adding things like the holiday lights shows. We did laser light shows. We did car concerts initially, and then we started working with one promoter, Raymond Ho, who always traditionally had the birthday bash and the major rager. He had done events with us, and we always had issues with noise in the parking lot, as you can imagine. He came back working with our events manager to propose a new layout that might work in a neighborhood like we are. So we tested it out, and it worked fantastically. So we've done, I think, now 8 or 9 concerts with him. We have 2 more in November and then 2 more in February. And those have been fantastic. 12,000 people was about the maximum we could do in that space. Finish them at 10 o'clock on the dot so the neighbors don't get mad. And if you think about it, 12,000 people is probably the largest venue in the state of Hawaii, which is kind of sad, but we're still at least serving that role as a gathering place for the islands.
Have you gotten any feedback from some of these musical guests that have been on island and you take them to the performance venue and they say, next to the stadium?
Yeah, you know, they do know coming in what they're in for. And I always do get a little bit of a chuckle when they say, it's so great to be playing Aloha Stadium. I'm like, oh, yeah, sort of. We have had opportunities for some much larger acts, but when they realize what the situation is, they say, okay, we'll wait for the new stadium to come. And that's always a little bit sad.
You could rebrand as like The Lot at Aloha Stadium.
Well, I like that. Maybe you got to come to our marketing team. That's a great idea. The Lot at Aloha Stadium.
I would love to, but I also do want to talk about these marketing meetings, because it's just, to me, an example of innovation where it didn't need to be. This could have just been a parking lot for however many years, but it seems like your team really took initiative to do something exciting.
I attribute it 100% to our team. So you'll laugh, and this probably makes me sound a lot older compared to you, but when we went through the whole downsizing, the reduction in force, we went from about 34 employees down to, I think we're at 16 and a half right now, halftime. We sat down in a room and we actually watched the video, Who Moved My Cheese? It's an old book about change and change management. And the idea was, we can't keep doing the same thing every day and get our cheese. We have to go do something different to get that cheese. That's the reward. And my staff took it to heart, and they aren't people that want to sit around and just wallow in their misery of, oh, when are we going to get a stadium? They said, well, we got this lot. Let's look at what we can do with it. And they're constantly throwing out ideas and fun things that we sit down and kind of brainstorm as a team and say, is that doable? Is it not doable? Is it worth the money and time? So they're creative. They like to do new things. The staff is fantastic, and they give me energy.
Let's return to our conversation with Ryan Andrews, the stadium manager for Aloha Stadium. Having the stadium parking lot unoccupied due to the lack of Rainbow Warrior games led to some pretty interesting economic opportunities, like leasing parking to Hawaiian Dredging Construction Company and NAN Inc. Those companies are employing thousands to modernize the shipyard at Joint Base Pearl Harbor Hickam, and there's no on-site parking for the extra manpower. This year, the Department of Business, Economic Development, and Tourism named Andrews Events and Operations Staff at Aloha Stadium the department's Team of the Year. The conversation's Maddie Bender asked Andrews what the recognition felt like.
You know, at first I was like, is this a joke? Like, what is going on? Are we getting kind of heckled here? But, you know, when you look at the numbers, don't lie. And although, again, we aren't fully fulfilling our mission, you know, we are still doing part of it. We are a gathering place for Oahu, and we've done it under pretty poor circumstances. And our revenue now is about 90% of what it would normally be with a full operational stadium. And of course, our expenses are a fraction of what they would normally be. So from a profit standpoint, we're looking great. Of course, we would much rather have a new shiny stadium to be operating out of and to be able to support like the University of Hawaii football and other activities as well.
And some more of those revenue streams, leasing the parking lot, that's pretty inventive.
We do a lot of that. So there are a lot of construction projects in the state where they have a lot of employees that need a place to park, and there's just not a lot of space. So we were initially contacted by actually 2 different construction companies that said, hey, can we just get a small portion of your lot? And so we would work out lease agreements with them for different sections of the lot. And then we had another, I believe it's a Halava View Estates that's doing a renovation on their apartment building, and they needed tenant parking. And so we had the parking lot where the rail station is, Of course, rail is only partially open. They don't need that whole lot. So we took back basically half of it and then leased it out to Halava View Apartments. So we, I think, have 8 or 9 different leasing contracts that are basically parking related. We have a few that are storage related. We have a couple companies that want to store stuff on the land. So we do that. We actually have one coming up where we're probably going to put their cars. They have a car dealership that's going to repave their parking lot, and they need a month or two of a place to store their new cars. Those are probably going to go in our field. It's a secure place. It's a great place to put it. It's not off limits. So, you know, again, we're using every piece of the property we can. I think I shared with you also the oddest thing we've done, I think, is we had a cat spay and neuter clinic. And so that was pretty hilarious. People drove in and dropped off their cat and then came back later and picked it up. And it's a great way to use a locker room that would normally be, you know, it's not being used right now. We also have the Department of Land and Natural Resources using it right now, and they use it through December for their officer training school. So that's a nice way to use it as well. So again, making the best out of a not so great situation.
But looking forward, you do have to kind of be nimble, because once construction begins, well, first, even before that, once demolition begins, mm-hmm. I know there is talk of moving the location of the swap meet, which will also cause changes. And so what's that going to entail?
No, that's a great question. So that is part of the whole transition plan. So we don't know how the phasing of construction will be until we have that developer, you know, fully under contract. But we anticipate that the first phase would be the stadium, pretty much in its place right now. So take it down and start building up the new one there. And then the connector would be to the rail station, our Halava lot, we call it, where the rail station is. That will likely be the first phase of construction, which means the entire south portion of the stadium is available for transitional activity. So the upper and lower Halava lots. So the natural place for the swap meet to go is that upper Halava lot. The lowest lot would be where parking is for the swap meet. So we do have plans already for that area to, one, bring in the necessary utilities, because we'll have to put in portable restroom trailers, which we've already purchased. We're waiting for them to be built and delivered. Some temporary office spaces, and then a food court with tents, and then obviously repaving that section of the lot. So that work is just waiting to go forward once we get the green light to do so. So the swap meet will be in that area, I would guess, for at least 10 years, you know, because the build out for the new Aloha Stadium Entertainment District is about a 20-year build out. So that would be a good transitional operation. In the meantime, before the developer actually gets down to that southern part of the lot, they'll have to have a new home for the swap meet in somewhere within the district.
You mentioned repaving that lot. I imagine that over the past few years, as the lot has been used for a lot of things it wasn't necessarily intended for, it's gotten maybe more use, wear and tear than expected. So even as, you know, modernizing the stadium's going on, how will modernizing the lot work?
Yeah, you're right. The lot is actually not in great shape, and it probably will never be in pristine shape until they actually are ready to develop it. So it's going to be more of just a resealing, resurfacing, so that it can be safe for the swap meet, so people can walk and not an issue for trips and falls. But, you know, if you look at the history of the stadium, all the little things that should have happened along the way, you know, refreshing paint, refreshing restrooms, making better suites and higher amenities, that never happened because all the money that was given had to go to structural issues. The stadium was plagued from the early years with the structural, the steel, as you probably know, the mm-hmm. Corten steel that was only supposed to rust for a little bit and then stop. And of course, it kept going, which is, you know, I guess a lesson learned for Hawaii.
How do you maintain optimism and like being able to think fast and go with the flow when it seems like so much is changing? And once you finally figure out a formula that works, oh no, the carpet's swept out under your feet again.
It has not been easy. I will be fully transparent. It's been like a roller coaster ride. At times you're like, okay, we have a plan, we're moving forward, let's go. And like you said, then someone pulls the carpet out from under your feet. So we've had it happen a number of times. What is my option? To quit and go home? I mean, I guess that could be, but that's not really how I'm wired. And obviously, it's not how my team is wired. We just go, okay, this is the situation today. What can we do? What are our options? So it's like, you know, like any game you play, right? You have to say, what are my choices? And look at what the best option is for the state of Hawaii, really. That's who we work for. So that's what we're looking at. But yeah, it's been hard. And I won't lie, it's been a challenge emotionally as well. And just, it's very fatiguing at times. At times, it's very gratifying when you can do an event like Megamon and see all these people coming on and enjoying themselves and having a good time with their family and dancing and eating. That's great. And that's what we're doing. We're making experiences for people. And that's what we miss about the stadium, is that you're creating experiences that people take with them for their entire life.
Yeah. Any ideas that you wish you could bring to people soon, or especially the wacky ones? I think people will love to hear about using the locker rooms to spay and neuter animals, you know?
Yeah, we have some crazy ideas, but nothing too out of the ordinary. We've done the different fun runs on the site, the bubble runs and the run where they throw all the color runs, those kind of things. We've done those, checked that box. We actually did a burlesque show in the parking lot. That was very interesting and unique.
When was that?
That was in, I think, late 21 as well. That was interesting. I think it was one thing that the board was like, really? Is that what we're doing now? But no, I think we're pretty much in that, I guess, I don't want to call it cookie cutter, but we're very comfortable where we are with the concerts. We're very comfortable with, you know, Megabond, 50th State Fair. Great Aloha Run is coming up again this February. We'll do that again. So I think we're in a good place. If new ideas come, hey, share them with us. We're happy to look at them.
Well, is there anything else that you want to add or you would want listeners to know?
Well, first of all, I just want to say thank you for having this conversation. It's, as you said, we've been operating the stadium the entire time. People say, well, stadium's closed. What do you do every day? They don't realize all the things that we're actually doing and all the people that come. You know, just the swap meet alone last year, we had, I think, 1.4 million visitors, attendees. That's huge. In fact, I think that might be number two in Hawaii in terms of visitor attractions. So it's pretty funny. And we continue to try to do creative things. And if people have ideas or need a space, give us a call. We might have some options for you.
Yeah, even if they need parking.
Even if they need parking, exactly.
Amazing.
All right, that was Ryan Andrews, stadium manager for Aloha Stadium, talking with HPR's Maddie Bender. Look for photos on our website later today showing just some of the quirky ways the Aloha Stadium events team has made good use of their space since the stadium was closed to the public.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art, with a mission to create relevant and transformative experiences through art with collections of Asian, European, and American works, including Arts of Hawaii and Textiles. HonoluluMuseum.org.
Hi, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, host of On Point from WBUR. Every day, On Point tries to help make sense of our world. We'll learn together, challenge our thinking, we'll meet some amazing people, and hopefully we'll have some fun too.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for HPR comes from Ruby Tuesday Hawaii, with locations in Moanalua and Kaneohe, offering dine-in and takeout daily and catering available for business meetings and events. RubyTuesdayHawaii.com.
And now it's time to reel in the answer to our backyard quiz. Earlier, we went trolling for the scientific name of a coral reef fish named after the 44th U.S. president. This basslet is pink and yellow in color. The male has a distinctive spot on the dorsal fin near the tail, blue around the edge, and red with yellow stripes in the center. Endemic to the Papahanao Makuakea Marine National Monument, most rarely exceed 4 inches in length and are known for their vibrant colorations. You may remember photos of famed undersea explorer Sylvia Earle presenting President Barack Obama with a picture of this vertebrae during his Papahanao Makuakea visit in September of 2016. Tosinoides Obama was discovered and named by Richard Pyle, Brian Green, and Randall Kosaki. And here are some more fun facts. Did you know that there's a trapdoor spider, a speckled freshwater darterfish, and an extinct lizard named after President Obama, too? And our winner today, Vicki Kennedy from Eva Beach. You got it right. But that's our quiz, and if you have an idea for one, send it to TalkBack at HawaiiPublicRadio.org. Plans are in the works for a memorial service for longtime HBR president and general manager Michael Titterton. He died at home in Honolulu on Friday. Michael led the station from 1999 to 2016 and oversaw tremendous growth in both the reach of the station and the growth of its membership. He also hired a lot of people, including HBR News Director Bill Dorman, who joins us this morning with some thoughts. Hi, Bill.
Aloha, Catherine.
Yeah, I was driving when I heard Dave Lawrence make the announcement on Friday afternoon, and it was, sad to hear.
Absolutely. You know, Michael's voice, certainly distinctive British accent, of course, bit of theater in there as well, and a good deal of passion always, and also a familiar greeting. Wanted to just remind our listeners about all of that and let you hear that again.
Hello, Michael Titterton here. The support you've shown to Hawaii Public Radio over the last 10 days has been extraordinary. Our goal of $861,000, the money we had to raise to stay on the air for the next 6 months, was met and even exceeded at 6:15 on Friday evening, right on schedule. Many thanks, and please see this for what it is, a resounding affirmation of faith in the strength and determination of our island community.
He had such a distinctive voice.
You know, and just that thought of leading with the community always, that was from the fall drive of 2011, actually, back in the days of raising $861,000, more than $1 million, that before sustaining membership really caught on. But it's not just, you know, the accent. It was a polished voice, a performer's voice that he always used in the service of HPR with drama, tone, and attention to nuance. Born and raised in London, definitely not what folks would call the posh parts, grew up in the East End. And he was born in 1948. And people might look at that and say, well, that was after the war. But people forget, and in particular, Americans tend to forget, the absolute devastation of Europe and the impact on London of the Blitz. So this was several years after the war, but it wasn't as if there were developers swarming all over the East End to make new projects. I just came across a 2019 story from the Daily Mail that mentioned 1950, saying 5 years after the war, destroyed masonry was being reused to construct new buildings, including homes, industrial spaces, as Londoners played among the rubble with much of the capital yet to be rebuilt. And Michael talked about that. Growing up, that was his playground as a kid. But he also talked about the magic of books and radio, and in particular the BBC, that took him away from the rubble and kind of tough streets and introduced him to a whole series of new worlds, started this lifelong love, not just of books and radio, but a burning for everything that reach of radio opened for him, the wide world to music, an outlet for an insatiable curiosity and really an aspiration for education as well.
And so how did he get from London then over to the U.S. and Hawaii?
Yeah, it started with education. There are some, I guess, foggy stories about young Michael. He was involved with cars very early on, apparently even raced cars for a while. Never talked to him about that. But he wound up heading to North America for college in Canada, grad school in Detroit, getting a master's in rhetoric at Wayne State University. Started working at his first public radio station, starting as a volunteer. Did some stories about the auto industry. NPR picked up stories on that. He went on to help a few college radio stations become NPR affiliate stations, really building public radio from the ground up. Virginia, Pennsylvania, he did that. And then he helped a radio station in Wilmington, North Carolina, get off the ground from getting a license, getting the building, getting on the air. And if you look up the Wikipedia page of WHQR, you come across the following. The first sound on the new radio station was that of a baby crying, then Bach's Toccata and Fugue in D minor, followed by then station manager Michael Titterton announcing, "Good morning and welcome to the very first broadcast day of WHQR in Wilmington, North Carolina."
Wow. Amazing. And then he ended up here, though.
Yes. Came to Hawaii in 1999, started at HPR, a delicate financial situation, started to expand the signal, working always with community groups on the ground first. First to the east side of the Big Island Friends of Public Radio, KIPO went on in 2000, then adding boosters for the North Shore of Oahu, local fundraising in Maui, KIPM, KQUA, west side of the Big Island into Kauai 2013, and meanwhile paid off the mortgage and stayed debt-free.
Wow. But yeah, just amazing to think, you know, he had a vision back then.
Absolutely. And that vision extended to a lot of things, including this very program,
yes.
The Conversation. He
yes.
started this back in 2011. Bethann Kozlovich, Chris Vandercook on the air, Kayla Rosenfeld producing with the help and continuing good work of Lillian Song, did other local programming here and elsewhere, and just, again, maintaining things. Always ideas, always the vision, yeah. always projects working, for
well,
sure.
Well, I felt very humbled because I think after our show that we did on, it was Marco Polo, we had a call-in show, and I think he emailed saying he'd heard it and he thought it was a good piece of long-form journalism. And I just was so honored that, you know, he said thank you.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's very Michael.
Very Michael.
Fiercely independent and intensely collaborative. And so many other things. I'll spare the adjectives.
Yeah, but we will miss him. And then family, then still figuring out services and all.
Services will be pending. We'll get more information on that, certainly. Extraordinary person. Good
right.
guy. He's
right.
missed.
Thank you so much, Bill. That was HPR's Bill Dorman sharing the lasting impact of former general manager Michael Titterton. That does it for us today. Tomorrow, we check in on another former HPR general manager, Jose Fajardo, as he works through his journey dealing with ALS. Do you have a story idea to share with us? Call our talkback line at 808-792-8217. You can find The Conversation as a podcast on our website or on Spotify and Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.